Tonight, the title is The Sexual Resolution and the Politics of Shame. And you probably are like, what is that going to be about? So I'm glad you're here so we can I can share with you what I mean by those terms. But I want to do several things, just looking at the order of the evening here. So first of all, I'd like to do a little bit of a recap of last week, and then we're gonna look into the sexual revolution a little bit, and then we're gonna look at what I call the politics of shame, and then we're gonna look at really how the sexual resolution to the sexual revolution is the theology of the body, and I'm gonna try to unpack why that is. Like obviously, I think we would all agree it is, but I want to sort of drill into that. Why is it the resolution to the challenges that we face in our times here with the sexual revolution? So just starting out with a recap, I was reflecting on last week, thinking to myself, that was a very ambitious outline that I had, and I tried to cover a lot. And sometimes when you try to tackle complex things in too little time, it's hard to do justice to a topic. So if that was how it felt for you, I apologize, but I think it's worthwhile highlighting some of the things we talked about. What I was trying to do was just really look at certain aspects of our current situation, especially with respect to the gender identity movement and in light of theology of the body. And, you know, I certainly was not trying to give an exhausted account of the causes of the LGBTQ movement. We couldn't possibly do that in probably even four nights, to be honest with you, if I was to just cover that topic. But I tried to just highlight a couple of things that I think sometimes we don't pay attention to or we don't look at. As Catholics or just as Christian people in general, I think we have a tendency to look at the moral fallout of these things without trying to get behind these movements and try to understand them from their root causes. And so I tried to just touch on some of those issues a little bit, just to try to provide a little context, both culturally and historically, to shed a light on the current situation. And what I suggested was that there's been a breakdown of proper gender socialization within the family and within society. And ultimately, I tried to map out this transition that we've seen from a society that promoted very strong rigid role assignments by gender and has migrated over into a society that believes that gender is fluid. And I tried to give some account of that transition. One thing I would clarify is that I wasn't trying to necessarily state that the role rigidity is a direct cause of gender fluidity, but I was trying to map two points on a historical timeline to say, you know, in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, we were here, and now in 2021, we're here. And that's a huge change and a huge shift sociologically in the way people think and people's mores around sex and gender. Trying to give some account of how that happened. But one of the main things that I identified was what I described as the tyranny of ideal forms. That this really has become the driver of this ideology for young people. So within the context of family breakdown, okay, and a lack of a proper gender socialization within family and society because of the breakdown of family, children, younger people have become very vulnerable and very susceptible to the tyranny of ideal forms. And this is, of course, pushed hard through our social media, but just media in general. And by tyranny of ideal forms, I mean that we put before ourselves idealized forms of performance and appearance. And it really empties the person of any sense of their own dignity because, first of all, most people can't live up to those ideals. And it's very alienating socially, especially for those who really struggle to fit in to those idealized social paradigms of performance and beauty. And so what's being pushed on young people today is an ideology that one can invent themselves. And we're told we can invent ourselves in many ways. And one of those ways, of course, is we can invent ourselves by identifying and defining what gender we have. That's what's proposed. But it's not the only thing that's proposed to young people. We are told that we can invent ourselves in any number of ways. Okay? But the idea is that underneath this, there's this kind of radicalized understanding of freedom in terms of determining oneself the way one wants to. Okay, so that's kind of like what's going on. That's what sort of sits behind it. Okay. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out is that we have to make a distinction between what I would call the causes of a problem and the strategies that people use to push the ideology. So when we look at the underlying causes of the problem, I've said it's the breakdown of marriage and family life. And we're going to push further into that tonight by looking at the sexual revolution, okay? And really understanding the root causes of the sexual revolution, because that's really where things really took a turn. But that's different than the strategies that people who are the architects of that ideology use to try to push the ideology. When you look at the underlying causes, that's what's more important than the strategy. So the example I give is this. If you think about drug trafficking, you could look at the problem of drug addiction in our country and say, you know, the problem is all these drug cartels south of the border. But the problem is that drug cartels only succeed where there's a marketplace for people who want to use drugs. And so while they might employ different strategies to smuggle drugs into the country, there's a more foundational, we might say, existential problem that there are too many people in this country that want to do drugs. And so until we deal with that problem, we're not really going to solve the problem. You know, you can shut the border down and try to slow down the flow of drugs. And that, of course, is good, and it would help. But there's a deeper crisis that we have to address. And I think that as Christian people, we have insight and perspective into those kinds of problems. So very similarly, there's an existential crisis in the world of psychosexual identity. And you can, you know, we could, in a more proximate way, we can blame the architects, the ideologues that are pushing the ideology. But there has to be enough people that are susceptible and responsive to this problem for it to become a movement. You know what I mean? So if you tried to push this ideology 40 years ago, it probably would have gone nowhere. You know, just like if you had tried to push abortion in 1920 or 30, it wouldn't have gone. But there are certain social conditions and contexts that make these kinds of things possible. So I hope that makes sense, but just by way of kind of summing up and sort of capturing what we're doing. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to try to push back further into the story, if you will, the genealogy of the problem, so that we can try to understand these root causes. Okay. Now, I need to, as I did last week, I want to admit, first of all, that I'm painting with broad brush strokes, and I can't avoid oversimplification simply because of the amount of time that we have. So to avoid oversimplification, I have to admit, you know, there are lots of tributaries that fed into the sexual revolution. Lots of things in philosophy, things in psychology, sociology, cultural movements, art, you know, there's a lot of things that came together into a kind of confluence that created the perfect conditions for the sexual revolution to happen. And so I'm not going to stand here and say that the things I'm going to talk about tonight are, again, exhaustive. They don't explain everything. But I want to put the attention on two things. One is Marxism, the influence of Marxism. And I use the term Marxism in the broadest sense, not simply in its socioeconomic meaning, but I'll talk about that in a second. And then secondly, I want to talk about what I mean by the politics of shame. Okay, because I think these are two realities that I think provide a lot of explanatory power for the sexual revolution. Now, it's a common narrative that we tell ourselves that the sexual revolution was really just simply a revolt against sexual mores, and people just wanted to have free sex, and so the sexual revolution happened. I think it's easy to kind of tell that story, but I think there's a much deeper narrative behind this that explains. And I want to go back to the concept of social hierarchies and what's called the problem of dependency. I don't know how many of you have ever studied the philosophy of Marx, but Marx was an avid student of Hegel. And Hegel was a bit of a social philosopher in his own right. And he had theories about how to explain, you know, the primary causes of social phenomena. And Marx picked up on a lot of Hegel's philosophy and developed a socioeconomic critique of capitalism. And in that critique, he basically argued that within the given structures of the capitalist economy, there were certain hierarchies of dependency within the economic order that led to the problem of alienation. And the problem of alienation for Marx meant that people were somehow disconnected from the means of production in the economic order because of the Industrial Revolution and other things. And so Marx's critique of the capitalist system, he identified, I think, some real problems in the way capitalism was functioning in the 19th century. But his solution to the problem was basically that you have to dismantle those hierarchies of dependency, okay? Because when those hierarchies of dependency become hierarchies of power and oppression, okay, you end up in a kind of binary system where you have oppressor and victim. And the only way you can liberate the victims is by deconstructing and dismantling the hierarchy of power. And you do that through revolution. Okay? You do that through revolution. So you through a social revolution, you're gonna dislodge the power structure, and then you're going to try to bring about a kind of egalitarian system where everybody is brought to the same level. And so that was Marx's socioeconomic theory in a very small nutshell. Now, the thing is that once people gravitated towards Marx's social theory, they began to apply his basic social critique to other areas of social life. Okay? And so if you let's just step back for a second and sort of look at the world, the social order, from a Christian perspective. See, we would argue, we would say, well, hierarchies are a natural part of human existence. Okay? There are some members of society are always dependent upon other members of society that have more influence, more wealth, and more power. In fact, Aquinas would argue that God creates the social order that way by design. Okay? So that there is a kind of interdependency within the social order that requires that everybody has to rely on other people for something, right? So the most basic example of this, of course, is in the family. You know, the children are dependent upon their parents. And then someday, the parents, when they get older, become dependent on their children, right? So God has built that interdependency into the nature of social relationships. But the problem is because of sin, those hierarchies of dependency can be corrupted, and they can become hierarchies of power, and they can become oppressive. So we can look out at the world and see all sorts of examples of injustice. Okay, and one of the ways in which, and we can go all the way back to Genesis, John Paul II spends a lot of time on this, but one of the consequences of sin is the disordered relationship between men and women. And if we remember what John Paul II said, in commenting on Genesis, he points out how Genesis tells us that the woman's desire would be for the man, but the man would lord it over, exercise a sort of unholy dominion over the woman. Okay, well, that's just a social hierarchy of oppression. That's another way of saying that. Okay, that's a biblical way of saying that. So, from a Christian perspective, the history of salvation has been the history of converting those hierarchies of oppression into hierarchies of service. That's been the goal. Okay? Christ modeled for us a different expression of authority, a different expression of power. And we speak about it as kenosis, as the self-emptying, the self-gift. Right? That's the way you take a hierarchy of dependency and you help it to function properly the way God intended it to, as a hierarchy of service, okay, where the greater serves the lesser. So those with more power, more influence, more resources are called by their social position to be in service of those, you know. So as a father, for example, I could lord it over my kids, and I could exercise my personal prerogative and, you know, and make my kids do anything I wanted them to do for me. I could do that, but I would be a tyrant as a father, right? I would oppress them in some way. In fact, St. Paul tells us, you know, fathers, don't provoke your children. Part of the meaning of that is, you know, fathers can be overbearing, okay? But if I understand my vocation from my positional authority over my children, I recognize that my job is to serve my children, right? To pour myself out for them and lift them up, as it were, right? To bring them to a place of maturity and more self-sufficiency and so on. Okay, so from a Christian perspective, you can kind of understand, I hope, how in God's eyes this works, right? God created these hierarchies of dependence, okay? But because of sin, they can be converted into hierarchies of power and oppression. And through Christ, he's trying to redeem our social life by giving us the example of the cross. So when Marxism enters the story, what Marx is doing is he's basically rejecting the Christian solution. He's saying that the way in which you overcome the hierarchies of oppression is that you dismantle hierarchies and you create an egalitarian society where everybody is the same. And therefore, you have to abolish any power structures that create dependency, because dependency creates alienation, and alienation is an offense against the dignity of the person. What happens in the sexual revolution, you know, again, we sometimes think it was just about free sex. People got tired of Elizabethan sexual mores and sexual repression, and Freud came along and said we should just have sex all the time, you know. And certainly for young people, you know, who are part of the hippie movement, that's exactly what was told them. Very similar to what we tell young people today. You can invent your identity. It's a propaganda, kind of propaganda that we put out to the young, because we're trying to shape and form the younger generation in a different ethical set of mores, a new morality, a new ethic. During the time of the sexual revolution, it was sexual liberation and freedom was the messaging. That was the propaganda, but that wasn't the agenda. The agenda was much deeper than that. The agenda was to try to dismantle the hierarchical structures of dependency between men and women. And the only way you could do that was through, I mean, this is why they introduced the contraceptive pill and abortion. Because if a woman was in a position of being able to get pregnant through sexual intercourse, then she was always going to be in a socioeconomic dependency on men. Because while you're pregnant, you know, at least that was the thinking at the time. Okay, so you have to liberate, if you're going to liberate women from this, again, applying a Marxist critique, if you want to liberate women from their social dependency upon men, you have to liberate their sexuality by, in a sense, giving them the rights that they want over the reproductive rights they want over their body. So it's no accident that we see a massive influx of women into the, you know, into the workforce with the advent of the pill. This was all part of the Marxist playbook. Not that women working is a bad thing. That's not what I'm trying to suggest. But the idea was to liberate women by liberating them from the biological determinism of their feminine nature. Now, part of that goes back to what we talked about last week, where there was, at the time, a lot of conflation going on between biology and social roles. And something that I didn't mention last week, but I think it's insightful. You know, we oftentimes tell ourselves that it's been a great thing that women were able to finally, quote unquote, go to work. But the reality is that for most of human history, men and women worked together in the economic order, and the primary locus of the workplace was the home, because most people were either farmers or shopkeepers. So it's only at the time of the Industrial Revolution that men left the home to work in a factory and women were left at home. And then men were working 14, 16-hour days, coming home exhausted, and had really nothing left to give to their families. Then on top of that, a lot of the industrial capitalists were putting up bars and houses of prostitution near the workplaces. So they were undermining the moral fiber of these workers. Okay, there was a lot of problem with alcohol. You can go on. You can paint the picture of the Industrial Revolution. This is why we had the workers' movement, why we had, you know, the development of labor unions and whatnot. But what happened then after that period of time is as people, there was this upward mobility economically, a lot of people began to move out to the suburbs, commute into work. So women were left at home in the suburbs, and men were going into work and working all day. But the thing I think we don't realize is that this is a historical anomaly. For most of human history, men and women worked together in the home to provide for the family. And so the economy, the economic order, and the home are the same place. In fact, the words are related, because the word economy comes from oikos, which means household management. You know, so what ends up happening is with that conflation of biology with role, you know, women stay home, men go to work. Women cook. These very, very rigid structures of men do this, women do this. That's actually a fairly new thing in modern history and culture. There was very much an equal division of labor in the home for most of human history. when you apply the Marxist critique to the problem of these social hierarchies of dependency, okay, it was almost like a fever. But we just start applying this Marxist critique to different things. So we apply it to the relationship between man and woman. We liberate the woman from her, the determinism of her biology, by giving her the pill and then abortion as an option so she has control over her reproduction. And therefore, she can be an economically independent, self-sufficient unit within the social order, and therefore liberated and equal to men. Okay, that was the solution. Now, I don't think anybody here is going to argue that men and women are equal and should be equal within the social order. At least I hope not, because that's a very Christian value and belief that goes way back even before the rise of feminism. The reality is that in the wake of that social transformation that came with the sexual revolution, that's where we see the breakdown of marriage and family. So we see divorces escalate. We see sexual infidelity increase. We see sexual promiscuity increase. We see an explosion of pornography. And so this leads up to what I talked about last time, which is that we have seen a breakdown in the proper gender socialization within the family and within society. Within the context of this social transformation, let's just put it this way, young people have been deeply, deeply wounded by their mothers and their fathers, and at large in society. Now, I'm not trying to cast particular judgment on any individuals. I'm just saying that as a social phenomenon, you know, we've seen a major problem emerge in and around sexuality and sexual morality and sexual identity, etc., because of this. Okay, so oftentimes as Christians, we keep condemning sexual immorality while not addressing the root ideology that's driving it. And that's what I think John Paul II is trying to do for us. He's trying to help us understand what the Christian response is to the ideology that's driving the degenerating morality. So I want to move on now and shift and talk about the politics of shame. And this is a strange phrase. You've probably never heard of it. And it's probably because I don't know if I coined the phrase, but I haven't heard anybody else use it. But what I'm getting at here is that shaming and scapegoating are universal and timeless strategies of social control. As human beings, because of the fall, one of the devil's greatest works in us is that he imprisons us within shame. And shame is a very, very destructive experience internally that is identified sociologically with all of the worst social indicators like suicide, depression, anxiety, drug use. Okay? It's very different than the experience of true guilt. But I'll leave that to another, that's a different discussion. From the dawn of human history since the fall, we have used shaming and scapegoating. That is, we identify people upon whom we heap our collective shame, and we tend to ostracize and marginalize those people. And so down through the ages, you can identify different groups that, you know. So for example, like I always use the example of alcoholism. We have a very different view of people who have the problem of alcoholism than we did, you know, even 50, 60 years ago. We used to shame those people. We called them drunks and bums. And, you know, we just thought they were moral failures through and through. And that was the end of the story. There was nothing more to be said. But we have a much more sophisticated understanding of what goes on inside the life of an alcoholic. And now we treat it as a disease. And we have much more compassion and mercy and understanding on that condition. So I just want to make that point. First point. Second point I want to make about the politics of shame is that during the period of Christendom, or what we call the modern period, and my source for this is Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age, if you really want to dig into it. Charles Taylor does a magnificent job of explaining the rise of the secular age. And one of the things that he talks about is the disciplinary society and the way in which modern societies became hyper-legalistic and hyper-rationalistic and very authoritarian. And that all happened under the umbrella of Christendom. So along the line, Christianity became very closely associated and identified with a very authoritarian, very legalistic, disciplinary society. Okay, so if any of you grew up in the time before the Second Vatican Council, you probably might have some recollection of how parenting was done, for example, or how children were disciplined in school. There was a lot of corporal punishment and, you know, And we might think that that's the way it always was, you know, within Christianity, but it wasn't always quite as severe as that. There was a real belief that you could legislate morality out of people through, you know, strategies of social compliance. And the primary mechanism of that was shaming and punishment. You'd shame people to prevent them from doing things, and then when they did the wrong things, you would shame them and then punish them very severely, oftentimes very publicly. So I don't know if you remember, but like, you know, if you grew up in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you might be sent into the corner, you know, and the teacher would draw a little circle on the chalkboard and you'd stick your nose at it and they'd put the dunce cap on your head. You know, that was real. Like, that stuff really happened. People really use these kind of tactics. Well, here's the thing. You know, we can understand how any society not influenced by Christianity would fall prey to the politics of shame. You can understand that. It's perfectly acceptable to understand how that would happen outside the influence of Christianity. But there is positively no excuse for Christians acting this way, because there is nothing in the Gospels where Jesus demonstrates that is how he deals with the problem of sin, and particularly the sins of the flesh, the sins of weakness. So think of the woman at the well and think of the woman caught in adultery. In fact, he said he modeled and demonstrated and taught exactly the opposite of that. So 2,000 years in, Christians have no excuse for creating societies and cultures of shame. But we did. And we did it kind of with a vengeance. Okay, it was very severe. And severe because in light of our Christian understanding of things, we should have been doing something very different. Okay? So as a consequence of that, part of the problem that we've been facing with is a lot of people have rejected Christianity, not because Christianity is false, but because they have experienced a false representation of the Christian faith. So prior to Vatican II, things were very strict and very authoritarian. After Vatican II, everything became really loosey-goosey. And we became, you know, more progressive. But both of those things have been terribly confusing to the faithful. So now we live in a time where the woke culture, that's the term everybody's using, used to be political correctness, and I mean it keeps changing names, but it's the same reality, okay? We hear about virtue signaling and different things like this. We just come up with new jargon, but it's the same reality. What it is it's the politics of shame. Okay? So we leverage tactics of shame, and sometimes we even use political power to back it as a way of forcing people into compliance with whatever set of rules we decide we're supposed to be living by, or whoever the powers that be decide we're supposed to live by. And so we're experiencing that a lot today. And it's very disconcerting. It's not only disconcerting for us as Christians, but it's disconcerting for everybody, because everybody's being forced to think certain ways and act certain ways. But what I want to point out is that this is exactly what human society becomes without the salutary effect of the grace of Jesus Christ. When we don't really lean into gospel principles, we don't really have effective ways of dealing with our disorders and our wounds. And so we do all sorts of crazy things. And one of those things is we try to normalize and rationalize disordered behavior, which is what we're doing today. We come up with all sorts of ideological reasons why this is good and holy and upright, when in fact we can see with our very own eyes how destructive it's been and how much it's hurting people. Okay? But the answer, the solution, is not to jump into the shaming game. You know, we can sit here and we can just become moralistic as Christians. And this is where I believe, and I'm gonna wrap this up here, with John Paul II's solution, which is to engage what's going on in the world through the theology of the body. He developed theology of the body as a real substantive Christian response to the challenges, the real questions, and the real struggles of a post-Christian and post-modern society, in which, because of a little bit of what I've shared tonight, people have developed an allergic reaction to the Christian faith. Many people, not everybody, of course, because they associate it with something that's tied up with a hierarchy of oppression and power and creating victims. And part of that is just false. It's just not true. But because of some of the darker and uglier sides of church history, it's also partially true. That's why John Paul II, for example, did the purification of memory back in 2000 to repent of all the things that Christians have done to misrepresent Jesus and the gospel. So to kind of bring this towards a conclusion, the resolution to the sexual revolution is the theology of the body. The theology of the body counters the social theories of modern philosophy. And it does it in this way. It counters the idea that everything is about power structures. It counters that through the logic of the gift, right? The answer is not revolution. The answer is not conflict. The answer is not opposition. The answer is not revolution. The answer is the gift of self. Theology of the body transforms social relationships through the power of the gospel, which is expressed most fully in the communion of persons. So when we cultivate relationships of communion, we are projecting into the world a counterpolitics to the politics of shame, which is about control. Okay, we create encounters rather than conflict. Theology of the body also conquers shame by proposing the spousal meaning of the body. It's hard to get around the relationship between shame and our sexuality. When you really look at it, the problem of shame has everything to do with the body, and it has a lot to do with our sexuality. So the counter to that experience of shame in and through the body is the spousal meaning of the body, that the body is good, it is a gift, and it is a gift to be given, and it is a gift to be received in love. Now, because that's not always so easy, right? Theology of the body also conquers shame through the redemption of the body, which occurs through the transformation of the human heart. So Christ's primary concern is with the transformation of the human heart. So again, take the woman caught in adultery. Clearly, he doesn't sidestep the woman's sin. But the solution that those who were holding the stones poised to throw them at her, contrary to that, Jesus opens up a space where he invites her to covenant communion with him through a new recognition of her dignity. And this is communicated when he says, "And neither do I condemn you. And neither do I condemn you." Or I think of the woman at the well, same thing. After she encountered the Lord and experienced a communion with him, she ran into her town and she told everybody that in the village that she had met someone that knew everything that she had ever done. There's a strange irony in that because everybody in the town already knew what she did. That's why she was going to the well at noon by herself. But clearly, Jesus made her feel differently than those her fellow villagers did. Okay? So Jesus offers redemption of the body through the transformation of the human heart. It's all about how the heart sees the other. And when we see the other through the logic of the gift, now we see and can affirm the dignity of the person. And when we do that, a person knows they're going to be grounded in their deepest and truest identity. It's really divine love that heals our wounded relationships and all of our identity issues. It's not conflict. It's not polemics. Okay. So as a couple of last comments, obviously in light of all of this, I don't think it should be lost on any of us how important Christian marriage is and how important it is to live our marriages and our family life well. It's the most powerful sign and witness of not only theology of the body, but the politics of God's kingdom, which is a politics of love and encounter and interpersonal communion. We really have to live out the theology of the body in the home.